Disc 8.
Look. He pointed far ahead to where in the smudges of brown, golden and yellow leaves, a sheen of light glittered. That might be the river. Or a lake, Michael suggested.
We're looking for a place called Blanchetac, Hook said.
They have the funniest names, Michael said, grinning.
There's a fort at Blanchetac, Hook said. We crossed that, and we're as good as home.
He turned as hooves sounded loud behind and saw Sir John and a half-dozen men-at-arms galloping towards him. Sir John, bare-headed and wearing mail, slowed Lucifer. He was looking off to the left where the sea showed beyond a low ridge.
"See that, Hook?" he asked cheerfully.
"Sir John?"
Sir John pointed to a tiny white lump on the sea's horizon.
"Green airs! The grey nose, Hook."
"What's that, Sir John?"
A headland, Hook, just a half-day's ride from Calais. See how close we are?
3 days' ride, Hook asked.
2 days on a horse like Lucifer, Sir John said, smoothing the destrier's mane.
He turned to look at the nearer countryside.
Is that the river?
I think so, Sir John.
Then Blanchetac can't be far. That's where the third Edward crossed the Somme on his way to Crecy. Maybe your great-grandfather was with him, Hook.
He was a shepherd, Sir John. Never drew a bow in his life.
He used a sling, Michael said, sounding nervous because he spoke to Sir John.
Like David and Goliath, eh?
Sir John said, still gazing at the distant headland.
I hear you got church married, Hook.
Yes, Sir John.
Women do like that, Sir John said, sounding gloomy. And we like women.
He cheered up.
She's a good girl, Hook.
He stared at the land ahead.
Not a goddamn Frenchman in sight.
There's a horseman down there, Michael said very diffidently.
There's a what?
Sir John snapped.
Down there,
Michael said, pointing to a stand of trees a mile ahead.
A horseman, sir.
Sir John stared and saw nothing, but Hook could now see the man who was motionless on his horse in the deep shade of the full-leafed wood.
He's there, Sir John, Hook confirmed.
Bastard's watching us. Can you flush him out, Hook? He might know whether the goddamn French are guarding the ford. Don't chase him away. I want him driven to us.
Hook looked at the land to his right, searching for the dead ground that would let him circle behind the horseman unseen.
I reckon so, Sir John, he said.
Do it, man.
Hook took his brother, Scald the Londoner and Tom Scarlet, and he rode away from the half-hidden horseman, going back towards the approaching army, and then down a slight incline that took him from the man's sight. After that he turned east off the road and kicked Raker's flanks to gallop across a stretch of grassland. They were still hidden from their quarry. Ahead of the four horsemen were copses and thickets. The fields here had no hedges, only ditches, and the horses jumped them easily. The land was nearly flat, but had just enough swell and dip to hide the four archers as Hook turned north again. Off to his right a man was ploughing a field. His two oxen were struggling to drag the big plough that was set low because winter wheat was always sown deeper.
"He needs some rain," Michael shouted.
"It would help," Hook answered.
The horses thumped up an almost imperceptible rise, and the landscape that Hook had held in his head revealed itself. He did not turn to the wood where the horseman was hidden, but kept going northwards to cut the man off from the Somme. Perhaps the man had already ridden away. In all likelihood, he was simply some local gentleman who wanted to watch the enemy pass, but the gentry knew more of what happened in their neighbouring regions than the peasantry, and that was why Sir John wanted to question the man. Raker was tiring, blowing and fractious, and Hook curbed the horse.
"Bows," he said, uncasing his own and stringing it by supporting one end in his bucket stirrup.
"Thought we weren't supposed to kill him," Tom Scarlet said.
"If the bastard's a gentleman," Hook said, and he supposed the man was because he was mounted on horseback, "then he'll be sword-trained. If you come at him with a blade, he'll like as not slash your head off. But he won't like facing an arrow, will he?"
He locked an arrow on the stave with his left thumb. He patted Raker's neck, then kicked the horse forward again. Now they were coming at the wood from the road's far side. He could see that Sir John had stayed on the slight crest, not wanting to spring the man out of his hiding place, but the lone Frenchman had scented trouble, or else he had simply watched for the approaching English long enough, because he suddenly broke cover and spurred his horse north towards the river.
"God damn him," Hook said.
Sir John saw the man ride away and immediately spurred forward with his men-at-arms, but the English horses were tired and the Frenchman's mount was well rested.
"They've no chance of catching him," Scall said.
Hook ignored that pessimism. Instead, he turned Raker and banged his heels back. The Frenchman was following the road that curved to the right, and Hook could gallop across the chord of that curve. He knew he could not outgallop the man, and so stood no chance of catching him, but he did have a chance of getting close enough to use the bow. The man turned in his saddle and saw Hook and his men and slashed his spurs back, and Hook kicked as well, and the hooves hammered the hard ground, and Hook saw that the fugitive would be hidden by trees in a moment, and so he hauled on Raker's reins, pulled his feet from the stirrups and threw himself out of the saddle. He stumbled, fell to one knee, and the bow was already rising in his left hand, and he caught the string, knocked the arrow and pulled back.
"Too far," Scoyle said, reining in his horse. "Don't waste a good arrow."
"Much too far," Michael agreed.
But the bow was huge and Hook did not think about his aim. He just watched the distant horseman, willed where he wanted the arrow to go, then hauled and released, and the cord twanged and slashed against his unprotected wrist, and the arrow fluttered a heartbeat before its fledgling caught the air and tautened its flight.
"Turpence says you'll miss by 20 paces, Tom Scarlett said.
The arrow drew its curve in the sky, its white fledging a diminishing flicker in the autumn light. The far horseman galloped, unaware of the broadhead that flew high before starting its hissing descent. It fell fast, plunging, losing its momentum, and the horseman turned again to watch for his pursuers, and as he did so, the barbed arrow slapped into his horse's belly and sliced into blood and flesh. The horse twisted hard and sudden, with the awful pain, and Hook saw the man lose his balance and fall from the saddle.
"Sweet Jesu," Michael said in pure admiration.
"Come on."
Hook gathered Raker's reins and hauled himself into the saddle and kicked back before he had found the stirrups, and for a moment he thought he would fall off himself, but he managed to thrust his right boot into the bucket and saw the Frenchman was remounting his horse. Hook had wounded the horse, not killed it, but the animal was bleeding because the broadhead was designed to rip and tear through flesh, and the harder the Frenchman rode the beast, the more blood it would lose. The horseman spurred his wounded mount to vanish among the trees, and a moment later, Hook was on the road and among the same trees, and he saw the Frenchman was 100 paces ahead and his horse was faltering, leaving a trail of blood. The man saw his pursuers and slid out of his saddle because his horse could go no further. He turned to run into the woods and Hook shouted,
"No!"
He let Raker slow to a stop. Hook's bow was drawn and there was another arrow on the string, and this arrow was aimed at the horseman who gave a resigned nod. He wore a sword, but no armour. His clothes, as Hook drew nearer, looked to be of fine quality. Good broadcloth and a tight woven linen shirt and expensive boots. He was a fine-looking man, perhaps 30 years old, with a wide face and a trimmed beard and pale green eyes that were fixed on the arrow's head.
"Just stay where you are," Hook said.
The man might not speak English, but he understood the message of the tensioned bow and its bodkin arrow, and so he obeyed, caressing the nose of his dying horse. The horse gave a pathetic whinny, then its forelegs crumpled and it fell onto the track. The man crouched and stroked, speaking softly to the dying beast.
"You almost let him get away, Hook," Sir John shouted as he arrived.
"Nearly, Sir John."
"So let's see what the bastard knows," Sir John said, and slid out of his saddle. "Someone kill that poor horse," he demanded. "Put the animal out of its misery."
The job was done with a poleaxe blow to the horse's forehead. Then Sir John talked with the prisoner. He treated the man with an exquisite politeness, and the Frenchman in turn was loquacious, but there was no denying that whatever he revealed was causing Sir John dismay.
"I want a horse for Sir Jules."
Sir John turned on the archers with that demand.
"He's going to meet the king."
Sir Jules was taken to the king and the army stopped. The vanguard was only 5 miles from the ford at Blanchetac, and Calais was just 3 days' march north of that ford. In 3 days' time, 8 days after they had left Harfleur, the army should have marched through the gates of Calais, and Henry would have been able to claim, if not a victory, at least a humiliation of the French. But that humiliation depended on crossing the wide tidal ford of Blanchetac, and the French were already there. Charles d'Arbray, the constable of France, was on the Somme's northern bank, and the prisoner, who was in the constable's service, described how the ford had been planted with sharpened stakes, and how 6,000 men were waiting on the further bank to stop the English crossing.
"It can't be done," Sir John said bleakly that evening. "The bastards are there."
The bastards had blocked the river, and as night fell, the clouded sky reflected the campfires of the French force that guarded the Blanchetec ford.
"The ford's only crossable when the tide's low," Sir John explained, "and even then we can only advance 20 men abreast, and 20 men can't fight off 6,000.
No one spoke for a while. Then Father Christopher asked the question that every man in Sir John's company wanted to ask, even though they dreaded the answer.
"So what do we do, Sir John?"
"Find another ford, of course."
"Where, pray?"
"Inland," Sir John said grimly.
"We march towards the belly button," Father Christopher said.
"We do what?" Sir John asked, staring as though the priest were mad.
"Nothing, Sir John, nothing," Father Christopher said.
So now, England's army, with only enough food for 3 more days, must march deep into France to cross a river. And if they could not cross the river, they would die. And if they did cross the river, they might still die because going inland would take time, and time would give the French army the opportunity to wake from its slumber and march. The dash up the coast had failed, and now Henry and his little army must plunge into France. And next morning, under a heavy grey sky, they headed east. Hope had sustained the army, but now despair crept in. Disease returned. Men were forever dismounting, running to one side and dropping their breeches so that the rear guard rode through the stink of shit. Men rode silently and sullenly. Rain came in bands from the ocean sweeping inland, leaving the column wet and dripping. Every ford across the Somme was staked and guarded. The bridges had been destroyed, and a French army now shadowed the English. It was not the main army, not the great assembly of men-at-arms and crossbowmen that had gathered in Rouen, but a smaller force that was more than adequate to block any attempted crossing of a barricaded ford. They were in sight every day, men-at-arms and crossbowmen, all of them mounted, riding along the river's northern bank to keep pace with the English on the southern. More than once, Sir John led archers and men-at-arms in a headlong gallop to try and seize a ford before the French reached it, but the French were always waiting. They had put garrisons at every crossing. Food became scarce, though the small, unwalled towns grudgingly yielded baskets of bread, cheese and smoked fish rather than be attacked and burned. And each day the army became hungrier and marched deeper into enemy country.
"Why don't we just go back to Harfleur?" Thomas Evergold grumbled.
"Because that would be running away," Hook said.
"That's better than dying," Evergold said.
There were also enemies on the English side of the river. French men-at-arms watched the passing column from low hilltops to the south. They were usually in small bands, perhaps 6 or 7 men, and if a force of English knights rode towards them, they would invariably draw away, though once in a while an enemy might raise his lance as a signal that he was offering single combat. Then, perhaps, an Englishman would respond, and the 2 men would gallop together. There would be a clatter of iron-shod lances on armour, and one man would topple slowly from his horse. Once 2 men skewered each other and both died, each impaled on his enemy's lance. Sometimes a band of French would charge together, as many as 40 or 50 men-at-arms, attacking a weak point in the marching column to kill a few men before galloping away. Other Frenchmen were busy ahead of the column, taking away the harvest to leave nothing for the invaders. The food collected from barns and granaries was taken to Amiens, a city the English skirted on the day they should have arrived in Calais. The bags that had held food were now empty. Hook, riding in a thin drizzle, had stared at the distant white vision of Amiens Cathedral towering above the city, and he had thought of all the food inside the walls. He was hungry. They were all hungry. Next day they camped near a castle that stood atop a white chalk cliff. Sir John's men-at-arms had captured a pair of enemy knights who had strayed too close to the vanguard, and the prisoners had boasted how the French would defeat Henry's small army. They had even repeated the boasts to Henry himself, and Sir John brought his archers orders from the king. He stood amidst their campfires.
"Tomorrow morning," he said, "every man is to cut a stake as long as a bow stave, longer if you can. Cut a stake as thick as your arm and sharpen both ends."
Rain hissed in the fire. Hook's archers had eaten poorly on a hare that Tom Scarlet had killed with an arrow and that Melisande had roasted over the fire, which was surrounded by flat stones on which she had made flat cakes from a mix of oats and acorns. They had a few nuts and some hard green apples. There was no ale left, no wine either, so they took water from a stream. Melisande was now swathed in Hook's enormous mail coat and huddled beside him.
"Steaks?" Thomas Evergold inquired cautiously.
"The French, may they rot in hell," Sir John said as he walked closer to the biggest fire. "Have decided how to beat you. You, the archers. They fear you. Are you all listening to me?"
The archers watched him in silence. Sir John was wearing a leather hat and a thick leather coat. Rainwater dripped from the brim and hems. He carried a shortened lance, one cut down so that a man-at-arms could use it on foot.
"We're listening, Sir John," Evelgold growled.
"Instructions have been sent from Rouen," Sir John announced. "The Marshal of France has a plan, and the plan is to kill you, the archers, first, then kill the rest of us."
"Take the gentry prisoner, you mean?" Evelgold said, but too quietly for Sir John to hear.
"They're assembling knights on well-armoured horses," Sir John said, "and the riders will have the best armour they can find, Milanese armour. And you all know about Milanese armour."
Hook knew that the armour made in Milan, wherever that was, had the reputation of being the best in Christendom. It was said that Milanese plate would resist the heaviest bodkin, but luckily such armour was rare because it was so expensive. Hook had been told that a complete suit of Milanese plate would cost close to £100, over 10 years' pay for an archer, and a heavy outlay for most men-at-arms, who thought themselves rich if they had £40 a year.
"So they'll armour their horses and wear Milanese plate," Sir John went on. "And charge you, the archers. They want to get in among you with swords and maces."
The archers were listening intently now, imagining the big horses with the steel faces and padded flanks wheeling and rearing among their panicked ranks.
"If they send 1,000 horsemen, you'll be lucky to stop 100 of them. And the rest will just slaughter you, except they won't, because you'll have stakes."
He lifted the shortened lance to show what he meant, then thrust its butt end onto the leaf mould and slanted the shaft so that the iron-tipped point was about breast height.
"That's how you'll drive the stake into the ground," he told them. "If a horse charges home onto that, it'll get impaled, and that's how you stop a man in Milanese armour. So tomorrow morning you all cut a stake. One man, one stake, and you sharpen both ends."
"Tomorrow, Sir John?" Evelgold asked. He sounded sceptical. "Are they that close?"
"They could be anywhere," Sir John said. "From tomorrow's dawn you ride in mail and leather. You wear helmets, you keep your strings dry, and you carry a stake."
Next morning, Hook cut a bough from an oak and sharpened the green wood with his poleaxe blade.
"When we left England," Will of the Dale said ruefully, "they said we were the best army ever gathered. Now we're down to wet strings, acorn cakes and stakes. Goddamn stakes."
The long oak stake was awkward to carry on horseback. The horses were tired, wet and hungry, and the rain came again harder, blowing from behind and pattering the river's surface into a myriad of dimples. The French were on the far bank. They were always on the far bank. Their new orders came from the king, and the vanguard turned away from the river to climb a long damp slope that led to a wide plateau of wet, featureless land.
"Where are we going now?" Hook asked as the river disappeared from sight. "God knows," Father Christopher said.
"And he's not telling you, Father."
"Does your saint tell you anything?"
"Not a word."
"So God alone knows where we are," Father Christopher said. "But only God."
The plateau had clay soil and the road was soon churned into a morass of mud on which the rain fell incessantly. It was growing colder, and the plateau had few trees, which meant fuel for fires was scarce. Some archers in another company burned their sharpened stakes for warmth at night, and the army paused to watch those men being whipped. Their Ventnor had his ears cut off. The French horsemen sensed the despair in Henry's army. They rode just to the south, tracking the army, and the English men-at-arms were too tired and their horses too hungry to accept the implied challenge of the raised lances, and so the French grew bolder, riding ever closer.
"Don't waste your arrows," Sir John told his archers.
"One less Frenchman to kill in a battle," Hook suggested. Sir John smiled tiredly.
"It's a matter of honour, Hook."
He nodded towards a Frenchman who trotted less than a quarter mile away. The man was quite alone and rode with an upright lance as an invitation for some Englishmen to fight him.
"He's sworn to do some deed of great valour," Sir John explained, "like killing me or another knight, and that's a noble ambition."
"It saves him from an arrow," Hook responded dourly.
"Yes, Hook, it does. Let him live. He's a brave man."
More brave men approached that afternoon, but still no Englishman responded, and so the Frenchmen became still bolder, riding close enough to recognise men they had met in tournaments across Europe. They chatted. There were maybe a dozen such French knights visible at any one time, and one of them, mounted on a tall and sprightly black horse that took the heavy soil with a high-stepping energy, spurred his way to the vanguard's front.
"Sir John," the rider called.
He was the Sieur de Lanferel, his long hair wet and lank.
"Lanferel, if I give you oats for your horse, you'll match my lance."
"If you give me oats," Sir John called back, "my archers will eat."
Lanferel laughed. Sir John veered away from the road to ride beside the Frenchman, and the two talked amicably.
"They look like friends," Melisande said.
"Maybe they are," Hook suggested.
"And they will kill each other in battle."
"Englishman!"
It was Lanferel who called to Hook, and who now rode towards the archers.
"Sir John says you married my daughter."
"I did," Hook said.
"And without my blessing,"
Lanferel said, sounding amused. He looked at Melisande.
"You have the jupon I gave you?"
"Oui,"
she said.
"Wear it," her father said harshly. "If there's a battle, wear it."
"Because it will save me?"
she asked bitterly.
"The novice's robe didn't protect me in Soissons." "Damn Soissons girl," Lanferel said. "And what happened there will happen to these men. They're doomed."
He swept his arm to indicate the muddy, slow column.
"The goddams are all doomed. I will take pleasure in saving you."
"For what?"
"For whatever choice I make for you," Lanferel said. "You've tasted your freedom, and look where it has led you."
He smiled, his teeth surprisingly white.
"You can come now. I shall take you away before we slaughter this army."
"I stay with Nicholas," she said.
"Then stay with the goddams," Lanferel said harshly, "and when your Nicholas is dead, I shall take you away."
He wheeled his horse, and after a few more words with Sir John, rode south.
"The goddams?" Hook asked.
"It's what the French call you English," she said, then looked at Sir John. "Are we doomed?" she asked.
Sir John smiled ruefully.
"It depends on whether their army catches us, and if it catches us, whether it can beat us. We're still alive." "Will it catch us?" Melisande asked.
Sir John pointed north.
"There was a small French army on the river's northern bank," he explained, "and they were keeping pace with us. They were making sure we couldn't cross. They were driving us towards their bigger army. But here, my dear, the river curves north, a great curve. We're cutting across country, but that smaller army has to ride all the way around, and it will take them 3 or 4 days. And tomorrow we'll be at the river, and there'll be no small army on the other side, and if we find a ford or, God willing, a bridge, we'll be across the Somme and riding for the taverns of Calais. We'll go home."
Yet each day they covered less ground. There was no grazing for the horses and no oats, and every day more men dismounted to lead their weakening, tiring mounts. In the first week of the march, the towns had given food to the passing army. But now the few small walled towns shut their gates and refused to offer any help. They knew the English could not spare the time to assault their ramparts, however decrepit, and so they watched the disconsolate column pass by and offered prayers that God would utterly destroy the weakened invaders. And God's displeasure was the last thing Henry dared risk. So that, on their last day on the plateau, the day before they would ride down into the valley of the Somme again, when a priest came to complain that an Englishman had stolen his church's pyx, the king ordered the whole column to halt.
Centeners and Ventoners were commanded to search their men. The missing pyx, which was a copper gilt box in which consecrated wafers were held, was evidently of little value, but the king was determined to find it.
"Some poor bastards probably stole it to get the wafers," Tom Scarlet suggested. "He ate the wafers and threw the pyx away."
"Well, Hook," Sir John demanded.
"None of us has it, Sir John."
"One goddamn pyx," Sir John snarled. "A pox on the pyx, Father."
"If you say so, Sir John," Father Christopher said.
"Give the French a chance to catch us because of one goddamn pyx."
"God will reward us if we discover the item," Father Christopher suggested. "Indeed, he has already lifted the rain."
It was true. Since the search had begun, the rain had ended and a weak sun was struggling to clear the clouds and shine on the waterlogged land. And then the pyx was found. It had been hidden in the sleeve of an archer's jerkin. A spare jerkin that he had evidently kept wrapped and tied to his horse's pommel, though the archer himself claimed that he had seen neither jerkin nor pyx before.
"They all claim innocence," a royal chaplain told the king. "Just hang him, sire."
"We will hang him,"
the king agreed vigorously.
"And we'll let every man see him hanged. This is what happens when you sin against God. Hang him."
"No," Hook protested.
Because the man being dragged to the tree where the king and his entourage waited was his brother Michael, for whom the rope waited. The king's men dragged Michael to the base of the elm tree where Henry and his courtiers waited on horseback beside the country priest who had first complained about the theft of his pyx. The army, commanded to attend, was gathered in a vast circle, though few except those in the foremost ranks could see what happened. Two soldiers in mail coats, half covered by the royal coat of arms, had pinioned Michael Hook's arms and were half pulling and half pushing him towards the king. They hardly needed to use force, for Michael was going willingly enough. He just looked bemused.
"No," Hook shouted.
"Shut your mouth," Thomas Evelgold growled.
If the king heard Hook's protest, he showed no sign of it. His face was unmoving, hard-planed, shaven raw, implacable.
"He," Hook began, intending to say his brother had not, could not have stolen a pyx. But Evelgold turned fast and slammed his fist into Hook's stomach, driving the wind from him.
"Next time I break your jaw," Evelgold said.
"My brother," Hook panted, suddenly straining to draw breath.
"Quiet!" Sir John snarled from in front of his company.
"You offend God, you risk our whole campaign,"
the king spoke to Michael, his voice like gravel.
"How can we expect God to be on our side if we offend him? You have put England itself at risk."
"I didn't steal it," Michael pleaded.
"Whose company is he?" the king demanded.
Sir Edward Derwent stepped forward.
"One of Lord Slayton's archers, sire," he said, bowing his greying head. "And I doubt, sire, that he is a thief. The pyx was in his keeping."
"It was found in his belongings, sire," Sir Edward said carefully.
"The jerkin wasn't mine, lord," Michael said.
"You are certain the pyx was in his baggage?" the king asked Sir Edward, ignoring the fair-haired young archer who had dropped to his knees.
"It was, sire, though how it arrived there I cannot tell."
"Who discovered it?"
"Sire, me, sire."
Sir Martin, his priest robe discoloured by clay, stepped out of the crowd.
"It was me, sire," he said, dropping to one knee. "And he's a good boy, sire. He's a Christian boy, sire."
Sir Edward might have protested Michael's innocence all day and not moved the king to doubt, but a priest's word carried far more weight. Henry gathered his reins and leaned forward in his saddle.
"Are you saying he did not take the pyx?"
"He..."
Hook began, and Evergold hit him so hard in the belly that Hook doubled over.
"The pyx was found in his baggage, sire," Sir Martin said.
"Then..." the king started, then checked.
He looked puzzled. One moment the priest had suggested Michael's innocence, now he suggested the opposite.
"It is incontrovertible, sire,"
Sir Martin said, managing to sound mournful.
"That the pyx was among his belongings. It saddens me, sire, it galls my heart."
"It angers me," the king shouted, "and it angers God.
We risk his displeasure, his wrath, for a copper box. Hang him!
Sire!
Michael called, but there was no pity, no appeal, and no hope. The rope was already tied about a branch. The noose was pushed over Michael's head, and two men hauled on the bitter end to hoist him into the air. Hook's brother made a choking noise as he thrashed desperately, his legs jerking and thrusting, and slowly, very slowly, the thrashing turned to spasms, to quivers, and the choking noise became short, harsh gasps, and finally faded to nothing. It took 20 minutes, and the king watched every twitch, and only when he was satisfied that the thief was dead did he take his eyes from the body. He dismounted then, and in front of his army went on one knee to the astonished country priest.
"We beg your forgiveness," he said loudly and speaking in English, a language the priest did not understand. "And the forgiveness of Almighty God."
He held out the pyx in both hands, and the priest, frightened by what he had seen, took it nervously. Then a look of astonishment came to his face because the little box was much heavier than it had ever been before. The King of England had filled it with coin.
"Leave the body there," Henry commanded, getting to his feet. "And march! Let us march!"
He took his horse's reins, put a foot into the stirrup, and swung himself lithely into the saddle. He rode away, followed by his entourage, and Hook moved towards the tree where his brother's body hung.
"Where the hell are you going?" Sir John asked harshly. "I'll bury him," Hook said.
"You're a goddamn fool, Hook," Sir John said, then hit Hook's face with a mailed hand. "What are you?"
"He didn't do it," Hook protested.
Sir John struck him again much harder, gouging scratches of blood into Hook's cheek.
"It doesn't matter that he didn't do it," he snarled. "God needed a sacrifice, and he got one. Maybe we'll live because your brother died."
"He didn't steal. He's never stolen. He's honest," Hook said.
The gloved hand hammered Hook's other cheek.
"And you do not protest at the decisions of our king," Sir John said. "And you do not bury him because the king doesn't want him buried. You are lucky, Hook, not to be hanged beside your brother with piss running down your goddamn leg. Now get on your horse and ride."
The priest lied.
"That is your business," Sir John said, "not mine. And it is certainly not the king's business. Get on your horse, or I'll have your goddamn ears cut off."
Hook got on his horse. The other archers avoided him, sensing his ill luck. Only Melisande rode with him. Sir John's men were first on the road. Hook, bitter and dazed, was unaware that he was passing Lord Slayton's men until Melisande hissed, and only then did he notice the archers who had once been his comrades. Thomas Peril was grinning triumphantly and pointing to his eye, a reminder of his suspicion that Hook had murdered his brother, while Sir Martin stared at Melisande, then glanced at Hook and could not resist a smile when he saw the archer's tears.
"You will kill them all,"
Melisande promised him. If the French did not do the job for him, Hook thought. They rode on downhill, going now towards the Somme and towards the army's only hope, an unguarded four-door bridge. It started to rain again.
There was not one ford across the Somme, but two, and better still, neither was guarded. The shadowing French army on the river's north bank had still not marched the full distance about the great looping curve, and the English, arriving at the edge of a vast marsh that bordered the Somme, could see nothing but empty countryside beyond the river. The first scouts to explore the fords reported that the river was flowing high because of the rain, but not so high as to make the fords impassable. Yet to reach the crossings, the army had to negotiate two causeways that ran arrow straight across the wide marsh. Those causeways were over a mile long, twin roads that had been raised above the mire by embankments, and the French had broken both, so that at the centre of each was a great gap where the causeways had been demolished to leave a morass of treacherous, sucking ground. The scouts had crossed those stretches of bog, but reported that their horses had sunk over their knees and that none of the army's wagons could hope to negotiate the terrain.
"Then we remake the causeways," the king ordered. It took the best part of a day. Much of the army was ordered to dismantle a nearby village so that the beams, rafters and joists could be used as a foundation for the repairs. Bundled thatch, faggots and earth were then thrown on top of the timbers to make new embankments,
while the men of the rear guard formed a battle line to protect the work against any surprise attack from the south. There was no such attack. French horsemen watched from a distance, but those enemy riders were few and made no attempt to interfere. Hook took no part in the work because the vanguard had been ordered to cross the river before any repairs were made. They left their horses behind, walked to the causeway's gap and jumped down into the bog where they struggled across to the causeway's next stretch, which led to the river bank. They waded the Somme, the archers holding bows and arrow bags above their heads. Hook shivered as he went further into the river. He could not swim and he felt tremors of fear as the water crept over his waist and up to his chest, but then, as he pushed against the slow pressure of the current, the riverbed began to rise again. The footing was firm enough, though a few men slipped and one man-at-arms was swept downstream, his cries fading fast as his mail coat dragged him under. Then Hook was wading through reeds and climbing a short, muddy bluff to reach the northern bank. The first men were across the Somme. Sir John ordered his archers to go a half mile north to where a straggling hedge and ditch snaked between two wide pastures.
"If the goddamn French come," Sir John said bleakly, "just kill them."
"You expecting their army, Sir John?" Thomas Evelgold asked.
"The one that was tracking us along the river," Sir John asked.
"Those bastards will get here soon enough. But their larger army, God only knows. Let's hope they think we're still south of the river."
And even if it was only the smaller army that came, Hook thought, these few archers of the vanguard could not hope to stop it. He sat by a stretch of flooded ditch, beneath a dead alder, staring north, his mind wandering. He'd been a bad brother, he decided. He had never looked after Michael properly, and if he was truthful with himself, he would admit that his brother's trusting character and unending optimism had grated on him. He gave a nod when Thomas Scarlet, who'd lost his own twin brother to Lonfarel's sword, squatted beside him.
"I'm sorry about Michael," Scarlet said awkwardly. "He was a good lad."
"He was," Hook said.
"Matt was too."
"Aye, he was. A good archer."
"He was," Scarlet said. "He was."
They looked north in silence. Sir John had said that the first evidence of a French force would be mounted scouts, but no horsemen were visible.
"Michael always snatched at the string," Hook said. "I tried to teach him, but he couldn't stop it. He always snatched. Spoiled his aim, it did."
"It does," Scarlet said.
"He never learned," Hook said. "And he didn't steal that goddamned box either. He didn't seem like a thief." "He wasn't. But I know who did steal it, and I'll cut his goddamn throat." "Don't hang for it, Nick." Hook grimaced. "If the French catch us, it won't matter, will it? I'll either be hanged or chopped down."
Hook had a sudden vision of the archers dying in their tortured agony in front of the little church in Soissons. He shivered.
"But we've crossed the river," Scarlet said firmly. "And that's good. How far now?"
"Father Christopher says it's a week's marching from here. Maybe a day or two longer."
"That's what they said a couple of weeks ago," Scarlet said ruefully. "But doesn't matter. We can go hungry for a week."
Geoffrey Horrocks, the youngest archer, brought a helmet filled with hazelnuts.
"Found them at the hedge," he said. "You want to share them out, Sergeant?"
he asked Hook.
"You do it, lad. Tell them at supper."
"And tomorrow's breakfast," Scarlet said.
"If I had a net, we could catch some sparrows," Hook said.
"Sparrow pie," Scarlet said wistfully.
They fell silent. The rain had stopped, though the keen wind was chilling the wet archers to the bone. A flock of black starlings, so thick that they looked like a writhing cloud, rose and fell 2 fields away. Behind Hook, far across the river, men laboured to remake the causeways.
"He was a grown man, you know."
"What did you say, Tom?" Hook asked, startled from half-waking thoughts.
"Nothing," Scarlet said. "I was falling asleep till you woke me."
"He was a very good man," the voice said quietly. "And he's resting in heaven now."
St. Crispinian, Hook thought, and his view of the country was misted by tears. "You're still with me," he wanted to say.
"In heaven there are no tears," the saint went on. and no sickness. There's no dying and no masters. There's no hunger. Michael is in joy.
You all right, Nick? Tom Scarlet asked.
I'm all right, Hook said, and thought that Crispinian knew all about brothers. He had suffered and died with his own brother, Crispin, and they were both with Michael now, and somehow that seemed good. It took the best part of the day to restore the two causeways, and then the army began to cross in two long lines of horses and wagons and archers and servants and women. The king, resplendent in armour and crown, galloped past Hook's ditch. He was followed by a score of nobles who curbed their horses and, like Hook, gazed northwards. But the French army that had been keeping pace along the river's northern bank had fallen far behind, and there was no army in sight. The English were across the river, and now had entered territory claimed by the Duke of Burgundy, though it was still France. But between the army and England, there were now no major obstacles unless the French army intervened.
"We march on," Henry told his commanders.
They would march north again, north and west. They would march towards Calais, towards England and to safety. They marched. They left the wide river Somme behind, but next day, because the army was footsore, sick and hungry, the king ordered a halt. The rain had cleared and the sun shone through wispy clouds. The army was now in well-wooded country, so there was fuel for fires and the encampment took on a holiday air as men hung their clothes to dry on makeshift hurdles. Sentries were set, but it seemed as though England's army was all alone in the vastness of France. Not one Frenchman appeared. Men scavenged the woods for nuts, mushrooms and berries. Hook hoped to find a deer or a boar, but the animals, like the enemy, were nowhere to be seen.
"We might just have escaped," Father Christopher greeted Hook on his return from his abortive hunt.
"The king must think so," Hook said.
"Why?"
"Giving us a day's halt."
"Our gracious king," the priest said, "is so mad that he might just be hoping the French will catch us."
"Mad? Like the French king?"
"The French king is really mad," Father Christopher said. "No, our king is just convinced of God's favour."
"Is that madness?" Father Christopher paused as Melisande came to join them. She leaned on Hook, saying nothing. She was thinner than Hook had ever seen her, but the whole army was thin now, thin, hungry, and ill. Somehow Hook and his wife had both avoided the bowel-emptying sickness, though many others had caught the disease and the camp stank of it. Hook put his arm about her, holding her close and thinking suddenly that she had become the most precious thing in all his world.
"I hope to God we've escaped," Hook said.
"And our king half hopes that," Father Christopher said, "and half hopes that he can prove God's favour."
"And that's his madness."
"Beware of certainty. There are men in the French army, Hook, who are as convinced as Henry that God is on their side. They're good men, too. They pray. They give alms. They confess their sins and they vow never to sin again. They are very good men. Can they be wrong in their conviction?"
"You tell me, Father," Hook said. Father Christopher sighed.
"If I understood God, Hook, I would understand everything because God is everything. He is the stars and the sand, the wind and the calm, the sparrow and the sparrow hawk. He knows everything. He knows my fate and he knows your fate. And if I understood all that, what would I be?"
"You would be God," Melisande said.
"And that I cannot be," Father Christopher said, "because we cannot comprehend everything. Only God does that, so beware of a man who says he knows God's will. He is like a horse that believes it controls its rider."
"And our king believes that?"
"He believes he is God's favourite," Father Christopher said. "And perhaps he is. He is a king after all, anointed and blessed."
"God made him a king," Melisande said.
"His father's sword made him a king," Father Christopher said tartly. "But of course, God could have guided that sword."
He made the sign of the cross.
"Yet there are those," he spoke softly now, "who say his father had no right to the throne, and the sins of the fathers are visited on their sons."
"You're saying," Hook said, then checked his tongue because the conversation was veering dangerously close to treason.
"I'm saying," Father Christopher said firmly, "that I pray we get home to England before the French find us."
They've lost us, Father, Hook said, hoping he was right. Father Christopher smiled gently.
They may not know where we are, Hook, but they know where we're going. So they don't need to find us, do they? All they need do is get ahead of us and let us find them.
And we're resting for the day, Hook said grimly.
So we are, the priest said, which means we must pray that our enemy is at least 2 days' march behind us.
Next day they rode on. Hook was one of the scouts who ranged 2 miles ahead of the vanguard and looked for the enemy. He liked being a scout. It meant he could put his sharpened stake on a wagon and ride free in front of the army. The clouds were thickening again, and the wind was cold. There had been a frost whitening the grass when the camp stirred, though it had vanished quickly enough. The beech leaves had turned to a dull red gold and the oaks to the colour of bronze, while some trees had already shed their foliage. The lower pastures were half flooded from the recent rain, while the fields that had been deep ploughed for winter wheat showed long streaks of silvery water between the ridges left by the ploughshare. Hook's men were following a drover's path that led past villages, but the hovels were all empty. There was no livestock and no grain. Someone, he thought, knew the English were on this road and had stripped the countryside bare, but whoever had organized that deprivation had vanished. There was no sign of an enemy. It began to rain again at midday. It was just a drizzle, but it penetrated every gap in Hook's clothing. Raker, his horse, went slowly. The whole army was going slowly, incapable of speed. They passed a town, and Hook, so dulled now to what he saw, scarce looked at the walls with their brightly defiant banners. He just rode on, following the road, leaving the town and its battlements behind until quite suddenly Hook knew they were doomed. He and his men had breasted a small rise, and in front of them was a wide grassy valley, its far side rising gently to the horizon, where there was a church tower and a spread of woods. The valley was pastureland, empty of life now, but scarred across the valley floor was the evidence of their approaching doom. Hook curbed Raker and stared, because right across his front, stretching from east to west, was a smear of mud, a great white scar of churned land where every blade of grass had vanished. Water glinted from the myriad holes left by the hooves of horses. The ground was a mess, churned and rutted and broken and pitted, because an army had marched through the valley. It must have been a great army, Hook thought. Thousands of horses had left the tracks that were newly made. He rode to the edge of the scar and saw the clarity of the hoof prints so distinctly that in places he could see the marks left by the horseshoe nails. He stared westwards to where that vanished army had gone, but he saw nothing, only the path by which the thousands of men had travelled. The scarred earth turned north at the valley's end.
"Sweet Jesus," Tom Scarlett said in awe. "There must be thousands of the bastards."
"Ride back," Hook told Peter Scoyle. "Find Sir John. Tell him about this."
"Tell him about what?" Scoyle asked.
Hook remembered Scoyle was a Londoner.
"What do you think that is?"
He pointed at the scarred earth.
"A muddy mess," Scoyle said.
"Tell Sir John the enemy was here within the last day."
"They were?"
"Go," Hook said impatiently, then turned back to stare at the myriad hoof prints. There were thousands upon thousands, so many they had trampled the valley into a quagmire. He had seen the drovers' roads in England after the vast herds of cattle had been driven down to their slaughter in London, and as a boy he had been amazed by the size of the herds, but these tracks were far greater than any left by those doomed animals. Every man in France, he thought, and maybe every man in Burgundy, had ridden across this valley, and they had passed within the last day. So somewhere to the west or north, somewhere between this place and Calais, that great host waited.
"They have to be watching us," he said.
"Sweet Jesus," Tom said again, and made the sign of the cross. Both archers looked at the further woods, but no glint of reflected sunlight betrayed a man in armour. Yet Hook was sure the enemy must have scouts who were shadowing England's tired army. Sir John arrived with a dozen men-at-arms. He said nothing as he stared at the tracks, and then, as Hook had done, he looked westwards and then northwards.
"So they're here," he finally said, sounding resigned.
"That's not the small army that was following us along the river," Hook said.
"Of course it goddamn well isn't," Sir John said, looking at the rutted fields. "That's the might of France, Hook," he said sarcastically.
"And they must be watching us, Sir John," Hook said.
You need a shave, Hook, Sir John said harshly. You look like a goddamned vagabond.
Yes, Sir John.
And of course the cabbage-shitting farts are watching us. So fly the banners and damn them. Damn them, damn them, damn them.
He shouted the mild curses, startling Lucifer, who flicked back his ears.
Damn them and keep going, Sir John said.
Because there was no choice, and next day, though there was still no sign of the enemy army, there came proof that the French knew exactly where the English were, because three heralds waited on the road. They were in their bright liveries, carrying the long white wands of their office, and Hook greeted them politely and sent for Sir John again, and Sir John took the three heralds to the king.
What did those fancy bastards want?
Will of the Dale asked.
They wanted to invite us all to breakfast, Hook said. Bacon, bread, fried goose liver, peas pudding, good ale. Will grinned.
I'd strangle me old mother for a bowl of beans now. Just plain beans.
Beans, bread and bacon, Hook said wistfully.
Roast ox, Will said, with juices dripping.
Just a lump of bread would do, Hook said. He knew the three Frenchmen would learn much from their visit. Heralds were supposed to be above faction, mere observers and messengers. But the three men would surely tell the French commanders of the English troops scurrying off the road to lower their breeches and void their bowels, of the sagging horses, of the bedraggled, silent army that travelled north and west so slowly.
They challenged us to battle, Father Christopher said after the heralds had left.
The chaplain inevitably knew what had happened when the three French emissaries met the king.
It was all exceedingly polite, he told Hook and his archers. Everyone bowed very prettily, exchanged charming compliments, agreed the weather was most inclement, and then our guests issued their challenge.
Nice of them, Hook said sarcastically.
The niceties are important, the priest said chidingly. You don't dance with a woman without asking her first, not in polite society. So now the Constable of France and the Duke of Bourbon and the Duke of Orléans are inviting us to dance.
Who are they? Tom Scarlett asked.
The Constable is Charles d'Albret, and pray he doesn't dance face to face with you, Tom. And the Dukes are great men. The Duke of Bourbon is an old friend of yours, Hook.
Of mine?
He led the army that ruined Soissons.
Jesus, Hook said, and again thought of the blind archers bleeding to death on the cobblestones.
And each of the dukes, Father Christopher went on, probably leads a contingent greater than our whole army.
And the king accepted their invitation, Hook asked.
Oh, willingly, Father Christopher said. He loves to dance, though he declined to name a place for the dance. He said the French would doubtless have no trouble finding us.
And now, because he knew the French would have no such trouble, and because his army might have to fight at any moment, the king ordered every man to ride in full panoply. They were to wear armour and surcoats, though most armour and jupons were now so stained or rusted and ragged that they would hardly impress an enemy, let alone overawe one. And still no enemy appeared. No enemy showed on the feast day of St. Cordula, the British virgin who had been slaughtered by pagans, nor the next day the feast of St. Felix, who had been beheaded for refusing to yield the holy scriptures in his possession. The army had been marching for more than 2 weeks, and the next day was the feast of St. Raphael, who Father Christopher said was one of the seven archangels who stand before the throne of God.
And you know what tomorrow is? Father Christopher asked Hook on St. Raphael's day.
Hook had to think about his answer, which, when it came, was uncertain.
Is it a Wednesday?
No, Father Christopher said, smiling. Tomorrow is a Friday.
Then I know tomorrow's Friday, Hook said, grinning. And you'll make us all eat fish, Father. Maybe a nice fat trout or an eel.
Tomorrow, Father Christopher said gently, is the feast day of St. Crispin and St. Crispinian.
Oh, dear God, Hook said,
and felt as though cold water had suddenly washed his heart, though he could not tell whether that was fear or the sudden certitude that such a day presaged a real and beneficial significance.
And it might be a good day to say your prayers, the priest suggested.
I will, Father, Hook promised, and he began praying that very moment.
Let us reach your day, he prayed to St. Crispinian, without seeing the French, and I will know we are safe. Let us escape, he prayed, and take us safe home. Blind the French to our presence, he begged, and he added that prayer to Saint Raphael, who was the patron saint of the blind. Just take us safe home, he prayed, and he vowed to Saint Crispinian that he would make a pilgrimage to Soissons if the saint took him home, and he would put money into a jar in the cathedral, enough money to pay for the altar frontal that John Wilkinson had torn apart so long ago. Just take us home, he prayed, take us all home and make us safe. And that day, Saint Raphael's Day, Thursday the 24th of October, 1415, Hook's prayers were answered. They were riding through a region of small, steep hills and fast-flowing streams, guided by a local man, a fuller, who knew the tangle of bewildering tracks that laced the countryside. He led Hook and the vanguard scouts along a wagon path that twisted beneath trees. The road to Calais was some distance to the west. But it could not be followed because it led to Esdin, a walled town on the bank of a small river, and the bridge there was guarded by a barbican. And so the guide took them towards another crossing.
You go north after the river, the man said. Just go north and you find the road again. You understand?
He was frightened of the archers, and even more scared of the men-at-arms in royal livery, who rode just behind and made the decisions about whether the fuller could be trusted. I understand, Hook said.
Just go north, the man insisted.
The path dropped into a valley where a village lay on the southern bank of a river.
La Rivière Tournoise, the man said, then pointed to the far bank where the hill climbed steeply. You go up there, he said, and find the road to Saint-Omer.
Saint-Omer?
Oui,
the guide said, and Hook remembered his journey with Melisande when Saint-Omer had been their goal, and Calais had lain not far beyond. So close, he thought. The nervous fuller said something else, and Hook only half heard and asked him to say it again.
The local people, the man said, call the Tournoise the River of Swords.
That name sent a shiver through Hook.
Why?
The man shrugged.
They are all mad, he said. It's just a river.
The river was shallow despite the recent rain, and the knight commanding the men-at-arms ordered Hook to take his archers across the ford and up the further slope.
Way to the crest, he said,
and Hook obediently kicked Raker down to the River of Swords. His archers followed him, splashing through water that barely reached their horses' bellies. The slope beyond the river was steep, and he and his men climbed it slowly on their tired horses. The rain had stopped, though every now and then a spatter of drizzle would sweep from a sky that grew ever darker. The clouds were low, almost black, and the air above the eastern horizon was the colour of soot. It's going to fairly piss down, Hook said to Will of the Dale.
Looks like it, Will answered apprehensively.
The air was oppressive, thick, full of a strange menace. Hook was scarcely halfway up the slope before a whole band of men-at-arms splashed through the river and spurred up the hill behind him. Hook turned in the saddle and saw the column closing up on the Tournoise far bank, as though a sudden sense of urgency had overtaken the army. Sir John, his standard-bearer close behind, thumped past Hook, riding for the crest that was outlined against the slate-dark sky, and a moment later the king himself galloped up the slope on a horse the colour of night.
"What's happening?" Tom Scarlet asked.
"God knows," Hook said.
The king, his companions, and every other man-at-arms had curbed their horses at the hill's crest, from where they now gazed northwards. Then Hook himself reached the skyline, and he too stared. Ahead of him the ground fell away to a village that lay in a small green valley. A road climbed from the village, leading onto a wide reach of land that was bare earth beneath the glowering sky. That bare plateau had been ploughed, and on either side of the newly cut furrows were thick woods. The battlements of a small castle just showed above the trees to the west. A banner flew from the castellated tower, but it was too far away to see what badge it showed. Something about the lay of the land was familiar, then Hook remembered it.
"I've been here before," he said, to no one in particular. "Me and Melisande, we were here."
"You were?" Tom Scarlet answered, but he was not really paying attention.
"We met a horseman here," Hook said, staring north in a daze. "And he told us the name of the place, but I can't remember it."
"Must have a name, I suppose," Scarlet said absently.
More Englishmen reached the crest and stopped there to stare. No one spoke much, and many made the sign of the cross.
because in front of them, and as numerous as the sands on the shore or as the stars in the sky, was the enemy. The forces of France and Burgundy were at the ploughland's far end, and they were a multitude. Their bright banners boasted of their numbers, and their banners were uncountable. The might of France blocked the road to Calais, and the English were trapped. Henry, Earl of Chester, Duke of Aquitaine, Lord of Ireland, and King of England, was given a new and savage energy by the sight of the enemy.
"Form battle!" he shouted. "Form battle!"
He galloped his horse across the face of his gathering army.
"Obey your leaders. They know where you should be. Form on their standards. By the grace of God, we fight this day. Form battle!"
The sun was low behind the lowering clouds, and the French army was still gathering under banners as thick as trees.
"If every banner is a lord," Thomas Evergold said, "and if every lord leads 10 men, how many men is that?"
"Goddamn thousands," Hook said.
"And 10's a low number," the centenar said. "Very low. More like 100 men for every banner, maybe 200.
"Sweet Jesus," Hook said, and tried counting the enemy flags, but they were too many.
All he knew was that the enemy was vast and England's army was small. "God help us," he could not resist saying, and once again he had the shivering recollection of the blood and screams in Soissons.
"Someone has to help us," Evergold said briskly, then turned to his archers.
"We're on the right. Dismount. Stakes and bows. Look lively now. I want boys for the horses. Come on, don't dawdle. Move your goddamn bones. We've got some dying to do."
The horses were left in the pastures behind the village as the army climbed the shallow slope to the plateau. The enemy could not be seen from the small valley, but as Hook breasted the rise onto the ploughland, the French were visible again, and he felt his fears crawl back. What he saw was a proper army, not a sickly, dishevelled band of fugitives, but a proud, massed army come to punish the men who had dared invade France. The English vanguard was on the right now, and its archers were furthest to the right, where they were joined by half the archers who had formed the army centre. The other half joined the rear guard, who now formed on the left, so the wings of the army were each a mass of archers who flanked the men-at-arms who made a line between them.
"Sweet Christ," Tom Scarlett said. "I've seen more men at a horse fair."
He was pointing to the English men-at-arms. There were fewer than 1,000 of them, and they made a pathetically small line at the centre of the array. The archers were far more numerous. Over 2,000 were now assembled on each flank.
"Stakes!"
A knight wearing a green surcoat galloped along the face of the archers.
"Plant your stakes, lads!"
Sir John, who had formed with the men-at-arms in the line centre, walked to where the archers readied their stakes.
"We wait to see if they attack," he explained, "and if not, we'll fight them in the morning."
"Why don't we just run away in the dark?" a man asked.
"I didn't hear that question," Sir John shouted, then went on down the line telling men to be ready for a French assault.
The archers were not in close array like the men-at-arms who waited shoulder to armoured shoulder in a line 4 men deep. The bowmen instead needed room to pull their long bow staves, and in response to shouted orders had moved some paces ahead of the men-at-arms where they scattered, each man finding a space. Hook was at the very front with the rest of Sir John's men. He reckoned around 200 archers were in line with him. The rest were behind in a dozen loose ranks, where they now hammered their stakes so that the points faced towards the French. Once the stakes were in place, the exposed point needed resharpening after the hammering it had received.
"Stand in front of your stake," the green surcoated man shouted. "Don't let the enemy see it."
"Bastards aren't blind," Will-o'-the-Dale grumbled. "They must have seen what we were doing."
The French were watching. They were a half mile away, still arriving. A mass of colour on horseback beneath banners brighter than the sky, which was becoming ever darker as the clouds thickened. Most of the French were milling around the skyline where tents were being erected, but hundreds rode southwards to gaze at England's army.
"I bet the bastards are laughing at us," Tom Scarlett said. "They're probably pissing themselves with laughter."
The nearest enemy horsemen were just a quarter of a mile away, standing or walking their horses in the ploughland and just gazing at the small army that faced them. To left and right, the woods looked black in the fading evening light. Some archers, their stakes hammered home, were going into those woods to empty their boughs in the thick undergrowth of hawthorn, holly and hazel, But most archers just stared back at the enemy, and Hook reckoned Tom Scarlet was right. The French had to be laughing. They already had at least 4 or 5 men for every Englishman, and their forces were still arriving at the northern end of the field. Hook dropped to one knee on the wet ground, made the sign of the cross and prayed to St. Crispinian. He was not the only archer who prayed. Dozens of men were on their knees, as were some men-at-arms. Priests were walking along the doomed army offering blessings, while the French walked their horses across the ploughland, and Hook, opening his eyes, imagined their laughter, their scorn at this pathetic army that had defied them, had tried to escape them, and now was trapped by them.
"Save us," he prayed to St. Crispinian.
But the saint said nothing in reply, and Hook thought his prayer must have been lost in the great, dark emptiness beyond the ominous clouds. It began to rain properly. It was a cold, heavy rain, and as the wind dropped, the drops fell like a malevolent intensity that made the archers hurriedly unstring their bows and coil the cords into their hats and helmets to keep them from being soaked. The English heralds had ridden ahead of the array to be met by their French colleagues, and Hook saw the men bow to each other from their saddles. After a while, the English heralds rode back, their grey horses spattered with mud from hooves to belly.
"No fight tonight, boys," Sir John brought that news to the archers. "We stay where we are. No fires up here. You're to stay silent. The enemy will do us the honour of fighting tomorrow, so try and sleep. No fight tonight."
He rode on down the archers' line, his voice fading in the seethe of the hard rain. Hook was still on one knee.
"I will fight on your day," he told the saint. "On your feast day. Look after us. Keep Melisande safe. Keep us all safe. I beg you. In the name of the Father, I beg you, take us safe home."
There was no answer, just the intense hiss of rain and a distant grumble of thunder.
"On your knees, Hook."
It was Tom Peril who sneered the words. Hook stood and turned to face his enemy, but Tom Evelgold had already placed himself between the two archers.
"You want words with Hook?"
the sentinel challenged Peril.
"I hope you live through tomorrow, Hook," Peril said, ignoring Evelgold.
"I hope we all live through tomorrow," Hook said. He felt a terrible hatred of Peril, but had no energy to make a fight of it in this wet dusk.
"Because we're not finished," Peril said.
"Nor are we," Hook agreed.
"And you murdered my brother," Peril said, staring at Hook. "You said you didn't, but you did. And your brother's death makes nothing even. I promised my mother something, and you know what that promise was."
Rain dripped from the rim of his helmet.
"You should forgive each other," Evelgold said. "If we're fighting tomorrow, we should be friends. We have enemies enough."
"I have a promise to keep," Peril said stubbornly. "To your mother," Hook asked. "Does a promise to a whore count?"
He could not resist the jibe. Peril grimaced but kept his temper.
"She hates your family, and she wants it dead, and you're the last one."
"The French will like as not make your mother happy," Evelgold said.
"One of us will," Peril said. "Me or them," he nodded to the enemy army, though kept his eyes on Hook. "But I'll not kill you while they fight us. That's what I came to tell you. You're frightened enough," he sneered, "without watching your back."
"You've said your words," Evelgold said. "Now go."
"So a truce," Peril suggested, ignoring the sentinel. "Till this is over."
"I'll not kill you while they fight us," Hook agreed.
"Nor tonight," Peril demanded.
"Nor tonight," Hook said.
"So sleep well, Hook. It might be your last night on earth," Peril said, then walked away.
"Why does he hate you?"
Evelgold asked. "It goes back to my grandfather. We just hate each other. The Hooks and the Perils, they just hate each other."
"Well, you'll both be dead by this time tomorrow," Evelgold said heavily. "We all will be, so make your confession and take mass before the fight. And your men are sentries tonight. Walter's men take first watch, you take second. You're to go halfway up the field."
He nodded at the ploughland.
"And you're not to make any noise. No one is. No shouting, no singing, no music."
"Why not?"
"How the goddamn hell would I know? If a gentleman makes a noise, the king will take away his horse and harness, and if an archer squeals, he'll have his ears cut off. King's orders, so you stand watch, and God help you if the French come."
"They won't, will they?"
Not at night.
Sir John doesn't think so, but he still wants sentries.
Evergold shrugged, as if to suggest that sentries would do no good. Then, with nothing more to say, he walked away. More French came to see their enemy before the night hid them. Rain swept across the plough, the sound of it drowning any laughter from the enemy. Tomorrow was St. Crispin and St. Crispinian's Day, and Hook reckoned it would be his last. It rained through the night, a hard, cold rain. Sir John Cornwell ran through the rain to the cottage in Maisoncelle, where the king had his quarters. But though the king's youngest brother, Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester, and Thomas, Duke of York, were in the tiny smoke-filled room, neither knew where the King of England had gone.
"Probably praying, Sir John," the Duke of York said.
"God's ears are getting a battering tonight, Your Grace," Sir John said dourly.
"Edge your voice to the cacophony," the Duke said.
He was the grandson of the third Edward and had been cousin to the second Richard, whose throne had been usurped by the king's father. But he had proved his loyalty to the usurper's son, and, because his piety matched the king's, he was deep in Henry's confidence.
"I believe His Majesty is testing the temper of the men," the Duke said.
"The men will do," Sir John said.
He was uncomfortable with the Duke, whose learning and sanctity lent him an aloof, distant air.
"They're cold," he went on. "They're sour, they're wet, they're hungry, they're sick. But they'll fight like mad dogs tomorrow. I wouldn't want to fight them."
"You wouldn't advise?" Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester, began, then hesitated and decided to say no more. Sir John knew what question had gone unsaid. Would he advise the king to slip away in the night? No, he would not. But he did not voice that opinion. The king would not run, not now. The king believed God was his supporter, and in the morning God would be required to prove that with a miracle.
"I'll leave your graces to arm," Sir John said.
"You have a message for His Majesty?" the Duke of York asked.
"Only to wish him God's blessings," Sir John said.
In truth, he had gone to test the king's temper, though he did not really doubt Henry's resolve. He said his farewells and went back to the cowshed that was his own quarters. It was a miserable, stinking hovel, but Sir John knew he was fortunate to have found it on a night when most men would be exposed to thunder, lightning, rain, and wintry cold. Rain beat on the fragile roof, leaked through the thatch, and puddled on the floor where a paltry fire gave off more smoke than light. Richard Cartwright, Sir John's armourer, was waiting. He looked more priest-like than any priest, with a grave, dignified face and a quaint, fluttering courtesy.
"Now, Sir John," he asked.
"Now," Sir John said, and dropped his wet cloak beside the fire.
He had taken off the armour he had worn during the day, and Cartwright had dried it, scoured it for rust, and polished it. Now he used cloths he had kept dry in a horsehide bag to wipe dry the leather breeches and jerkin that Sir John wore. The leather was supple deer hide, and the two expensive garments had been made by a tailor in London so that they fitted Sir John like a second skin. Cartwright said nothing as he wiped handfuls of lanolin onto the deer hide. Sir John was lost in his own thoughts. He had done this so often, stood with his hands outstretched as Cartwright made the leather arms and legs slippery so that the armour above would move easily. He thought back to tournaments and battles, to the excitement that always accompanied the anticipation of those contests, but he sensed no excitement tonight. The rain hammered, the cold wind gusted drops through the cowshed door, and Sir John thought of the thousands of Frenchmen whose armourers were also readying them for battle. So many thousands, he thought. Too many.
"You spoke, Sir John?" Cartwright said.
"Did I?"
"I'm sure I misheard, Sir John. Raise your arms, please."
Cartwright dropped a mail harbourgeon over Sir John's head. The chain mail was close-linked, sleeveless, and dropped to Sir John's groin. The armholes were wide, so that Sir John would not be hampered by its constriction.
"Forgive me, Sir John," Cartwright murmured, as he always did when he knelt in front of his master,
and laced the front and back hems of the harbourgeon between Sir John's legs. Sir John said nothing. Cartwright also kept silent as he buckled the cuisse to Sir John's thighs. The front ones slightly overlapped the back ones, and Sir John flexed his legs to make sure the steel plates moved smoothly against each other. He did not ask for any adjustment because Cartwright knew precisely what he was doing. Next came the greaves to protect Sir John's calves,
and the roundels for his knees and the plate-covered boots that were buckled to the greaves. Cartwright stood and strapped the skirt into place. The skirt was leather, covered with mail, and then plated with overlapping strips of steel to protect Sir John's groin.
End of Disc 8.